From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. On the show today, Massachusetts Transportation Secretary Stephanie Pollock joins us to talk about transportation funding in the new Trump administration, all-electronic tolling, and the MBTA. She'll take your calls, too. Also, President-elect Trump has said he wants the U.S. to pull out of the Paris Climate Agreement. Could he do it? And if so, how?
To pull out of the convention would disrupt international relations in dimensions that go beyond climate change.
And we speak with Diana Ploss, the longtime Massachusetts Democrat turned Republican and Donald Trump supporter. She shares her message for fellow Bay Staters who are worried about the nation's future.
Trump supporters are not a group of white nationalists. We're a very varied group of people. We're not monsters. We believe in America, and we believe in America first.
That's all next on Radio Boston. First the news.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We'll start today with Stephanie Pollock. She's the Commonwealth's Transportation Secretary, and she joins us in the studio to talk about the future of transportation under the Trump administration, about all-electronic tolling, about the MBTA here in Massachusetts, and much more. She'll also take your calls. So what is your question for Transportation Secretary Pollock? You can call us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. You can also send us a tweet at Radio Boston. And if you'd like, you can watch our conversation on Facebook Live. Go to facebook.com/Radio Boston to watch the feed and submit questions there. Secretary Pollock, it's great to have you back on the show.
It's great to be here.
So first of all, I do want to start at the federal level for a moment because we can't really escape that we just have had a history-making election. And as you might recall, during the campaign, then-candidate Donald Trump, you know, talked about having a 10-year, $1 trillion program to rebuild the nation's infrastructure, highways, tunnels, bridges, airports. You know, say that actually happens. It's a giant if in Washington. But, you know, could any of that have an impact on Massachusetts?
Absolutely. You know, transportation and transportation investment have historically been a bipartisan or nonpartisan issue. One of the relatively small number of things that Congress was able to agree on in the months leading up to the election was a 6-year transportation funding plan. So we already have a lot of assurances around federal funding levels. And this is after like 24 short-term extensions of the old rules. So I think that a lot of us in the field are optimistic that we are going to be able to make progress because, you know, everybody wants to see our infrastructure be upgraded. And I think everyone understands that it is one of the most fundamental roles of government, no matter what your other perspectives are on what government should or shouldn't do. But one of them is building infrastructure that then allows companies and communities to prosper.
But on the other hand, the federal government hasn't really done anything to really fix the Federal Highway Trust Fund, of course, that relies on the gas tax, the federal gas tax. That hasn't been changed in more than 20 years. So these sort of some of the fundamentals in terms of paying for major infrastructure and transportation projects, do you see any optimism for our ability to do that?
I mean, we'll obviously have to see what the specific solutions are, but there's a lot of there's a lot of different ways to approach it. And if there's really a bipartisan consensus that we need to be doing more, hopefully there'll be some innovative ideas that'll come up.
Mm. Well, let's take it down here to the level of the state of Massachusetts. The Green Line extension, a more than $2 billion project. Remind me how much of that comes from or is slated to come from federal funds?
So we have a signed full funding grant agreement with the federal government, the Federal Transit Administration, that provides just under $1 billion. And we have been actively working with the Federal Transit Administration to meet all the conditions that are necessary to unlock that money and actually award a new construction contract and get going again.
Do you know if and when that might happen?
So actually, this morning, I was over at the transportation building with a group of major contracting companies who were coming to hear about the procurement and the bidding on that. And so we're moving ahead with a new procurement. We're moving ahead with putting a new management team in place because we know that the last one was not managed properly. And those are among the last preconditions that we will need to work with the federal government on. So we definitely expect to see tangible progress in 2017.
The beginning of 2017?
Well, I mean, we need to, again, we won't be back in construction probably in 2017 because we got a lot of work to do on design and permitting and funding and procurement. But we'll be building the team and working with the feds and getting everything back on track, assuming that the new design stays within the funding resources that we have available. It had, as you may remember, skyrocketed up to about $3 billion, and as a $3 billion project, we can't build it. But as a $2.3 billion project, we absolutely can.
Is there any chance that the design could cross over outside of
that?
Well,
that's what we're working on now. But I think that we have a high degree of confidence that we're headed in the right direction.
So let me ask you, I mean, January 2017 takes us into the Trump administration. Is there any part of you that has any concern that this agreement with the federal government could get undone by the next president?
I don't expect that to be a problem.
You sound very confident.
You know, there is a long history on these kinds of big projects surviving changes in administration. Major infrastructure projects, as I said, have been bipartisan, and they also take years and sometimes decades. And folks in Washington are well aware that you can't keep changing the rules all the time. And so there's a long history of projects surviving changes in administrations, including, you know, the big dig. Hmm. Went through a bunch of changes in administration. The money came.
Well, tell us a little bit about the person who's been named as the new manager of the Green Line Extension, John Dalton. He was just hired this month,
yep.
Right? And former manager at the Chicago Transit Authority. What does he bring? Can he help us get the Green Line Extension
built? Well, I think he can because the federal funding program that we are using to build the Green Line Extension is called the New Starts Program. And one of the concerns that the federal government has had in terms of releasing the funding is, have we built a management team that can succeed this time? Because the last one didn't. John Dalton successfully managed not one but two New Starts funded projects for the Chicago Transit Authority. And so he is a known commodity at FTA. He understands that program. He has delivered these projects on time and on budget. And that's one of the most important reasons why we brought him on board.
Yeah. You know, when he got hired, there was a little burst of news around the fact that the T was also saying that it believes some of its senior managers are actually underpaid and that senior management should get higher wages. I mean, obviously, anything around salaries at the T always attracts attention and controversy. I mean, what do you think about that?
Obviously, it does attract controversy. But on the other hand, if we want to fix the T, and that is kind of fundamentally one of my most important jobs as transportation secretary, not just deliver the Green Line, but fix the T, we need to pay what the market is. And the T has actually historically not paid what fellow transit agencies do. The other thing on the Green Line specifically is he's managing a $2 billion plus program. It is way, you know, 1-3% over budget is way more than this gentleman's salary is. So if we can hire a management team that will manage it to budget and schedule, we will save far more than we will spend by investing in talent.
Mm. And his salary is $280,000 annually. I mean, are there things in his contract that encourage him to get this thing done?
Yes,
on time?
There are performance incentives as well, and we're excited about that because that's not historically how we pay public sector folks, but the private sector does it all the time, and we want him to be invested in succeeding.
Mm. We're speaking with Transportation Secretary Stephanie Pollack. If you've got questions about the Green Line Extension, about the MBTA as a whole, or maybe about all electronic tolling that has come to Massachusetts, or anything regarding our roads, our bridges, and our trains, call us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. You can also send us a tweet at Radio Boston. Secretary Pollack, let's step back here for a minute, because you know I always like talking to you about the MBTA as a whole.
Yep.
It's obviously still got a lot of problems, and I just wonder what you would say to people who... Okay, the Green Line Extension is one thing. It's got a plan, a budget, and a deadline. But the whole rest of the system still isn't serving Eastern Massachusetts the way it needs to in order to propel the state and the economy, you know, further into the 21st century. Is it possible we would ever get an MBTA that Massachusetts needs?
Absolutely, it's possible. People deserve it. People demand it. It's not going to happen overnight. You don't fix not years, but decades of underinvestment and underplanning by, you know, waving a magic wand and getting everything to work. But, you know, the New York City subway system was in terrible shape, and they put together an investment plan and brought in new leadership and brought it back. And we're going to do the same thing at the T. It's too important not to get it right. And I actually appreciate the fact that the vast majority of our writers have been really patient and giving us the room that we need to sort of dissect what's gone wrong and understand where we can make the most effective investments that will result in people seeing concrete improvements in service in the shortest time frame possible.
What about privatization? Because the T recently agreed to pay McKinsey and Company, what, $1 million to look at ways to save money, which might include privatization on what, on some bus operations?
So, you know, what's interesting is outside of Massachusetts, privatization is one tool in the toolkit that every transit operator in the United States has. We are actually the only major transit operator that doesn't at least look at the possibility. And let me give you an example. The MBTA needs to fix the system it has faster. Historically, the T only runs one major construction project weekends during the construction season. So we close a part of the system and we go fix it and we run a bus diversion. One of the reasons we only do those one at a time is we don't have enough buses or bus drivers to do more than one at a time. So if we can contract out for weekend substitute bus service so that we could fix two or three or four parts of the system every weekend starting next spring when the construction season starts, we'll get it fixed faster. So privatization is not just about, you know, taking the whole system and privatizing it. What the legislature gave us the ability to do is use it strategically. We have privatized the cash room because the T's not in the business of moving money. It's in the business of moving people. Bank of America doesn't run its own cash room. It contracts it out. So we need to get the T out of businesses that are not their core businesses, and we need to give them the bandwidth to deliver good service to people.
Are there areas of the T that you would not like to see privatized?
You know, right now, the T runs five different services. It runs trains, subway trains, buses, commuter rail, ferries, and a paratransit service called the Ride. Three of those five are not only privatized, they have been privatized. There was never a T-run commuter rail. There was never a T-run paratransit system. Two are not, the buses and the subway system. So to me, the issue is not whether it's run by the private sector or the public sector, or if the workforce happens to be on a private payroll or a public, it's what's the most cost-effective way to give great service. And if it's public sector employees, we should use them. And if it's private sector companies, we should use those. And that's what we're really doing, is sorting out what's the best way to provide each, not just each service, but each subcomponent of what the T does.
You know, it's interesting because you mentioned it's the Ride, the ferries, and the, which other one is?
Commuter rail.
Commuter rails. Well, so all three of them have had major problems, though.
All three of them have a higher on-time performance rate than either the buses or the subway system.
So you're comparing them to the buses and the subway system, but, you know, what about all the massive failures that commuter rail has had in,
again,
in
every part
years?
Of the system has problems, but what I'm saying is the privatized parts do, but so do the parts run by the public employees. That's why I say the issue is not public versus private. It's productivity, it's reliability, and contracting out is a tool. It's not a silver bullet, but it is a tool the T lacked, and now it has it. I actually think that the control board and the management team have used that tool very strategically and in a very limited way. They've had that tool now for a year and a half, and they've only done a handful of contracts. This is not about a wholesale ideological war on public sector employees. This is about having an option that didn't exist before if that's what it takes to get the job done.
Well, we're talking with Massachusetts Transportation Secretary Stephanie Pollack, and you won't be surprised to know that a lot of people want to talk with you. We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. Let's go to Rick, who's calling from Marblehead. You're on the air, Rick.
Yes, talking about contracting out services, particularly commuter rail and Keolis. I've read in the paper how you have not collected, or have actually probably waived, fines or for not performing under their contract, particularly finding late service. or delayed service. Can you tell me how you justify not collecting the provisions that are provided for in your contract recently, and then what are you planning to do in the future? Are you just not going to collect the payments that are due for late service or not performing on time?
Rick, thanks for your call.
It's a great question, Rick. Every month we fine Keolis hundreds of thousands of dollars under the contract, but your point is exactly that. We have to fine them under the contract, and the contract excuses certain performance lapses. So, for example, and this actually just happened yesterday to the Green Line, if the police in a community stop the trains and say, don't run the trains, we're doing a police investigation, we can't, under the contract, we can't fine Keolis because their train was late. So for every single train that's late, every single month, we go through the contractual provisions, and when we are contractually able to fine them, because it's their fault, we absolutely do. And when the contract itself provides that it is not a situation that Keolis is accountable, we don't fine them. But I don't want people to think that we are just sitting around waiving all responsibility. They have been fined every single month since they have been the operator, and they have been fined to the extent, the maximum extent that the contract allows us to fine them.
But it was, what, just last month that State Representative William Strauss, who's the chair of the legislature's Transportation Committee, he called for the state to reopen the contract with Keolis because he thinks it's flawed.
So we have met with Chairman Strauss, and we are taking a look at the contract, and we have actually made changes in the contract that are designed to help increase the accountability of Keolis and the reliability of the service. So the contract is an 8-year contract. It was negotiated before I became secretary, and I'm not going to tell you it's perfect. I think it's actually much better than the prior contract. And I can tell you that despite all the frustration that people see, and I am a commuter rail rider, and I ride one of the lowest performing lines, the Worcester-Framingham line, so this affects my life. There's a long way to go on the operations, but on average, this operator is actually doing a little bit better than the prior two operators. It's a tough system to run. And remember, the T, not the operator, is responsible for the coaches and the trains and the tracks. And sometimes when the system fails, it fails because the infrastructure fails, not because the operator fails.
Well, that gets us to a bigger problem then as well. But let's turn to Nicole, who's calling from Hyde Park. You're on the air, Nicole.
Hi, good afternoon. I had a question in terms of contractors that work with the T. There have been some concerns that the T has not made an effort to hire minority contractors or vendors, and that does not represent the community at large. I'm wondering if that's changing or if an effort is being made.
Nicole, thank you for your call.
So it's really important for us to try to take the resources that are invested actually both at the T and at the highway department, at the transportation department, and make sure that as a certain proportion of them actually goes to disadvantaged business enterprises. And we've actually started separately a program just for all small businesses. So we are trying really hard to make it easier for people to get some of that work. We've looked at things like breaking contracts into smaller pieces so that more different kinds of businesses can compete from them. We've been doing fairs. We've been doing outreach. If folks have suggestions for how we could do a better job, we absolutely want to hear them, because we are actually spending more money on the T than we've historically spent. And while the ultimate purpose of that investment is to provide people with great service, it's also a great opportunity to have as many different kinds of companies as possible getting a piece of that investment and employing people.
Well, let me ask you a different equity question here, because as you know, the Boston Globe reported recently about cancellations on the Fairmont line. They reported that for 5 straight days last month, the 625 train was canceled. Altogether, some 17 trains on the Fairmont line were canceled in a month. So riders were frequently stranded. And I mean, that line was meant to give greater access to some communities in Boston that didn't have it before. I mean, are you concerned about equity in terms of the service provided to Fairmont line riders?
Absolutely. It's a really important service. I mean, every service we provide is important, but that's a community where in many cases, if the train is canceled, folks may not have another option. They may not have a car sitting in their driveway. They may not have enough money in their wallet to just grab an Uber. As we have told Keolis in no uncertain terms that that was unacceptable. They have stopped canceling those trains. There is an investigation into what they did. They have been meeting with the community as well as the legislatures that have raised a concern. And we need to, but the underlying problem was not a desire to deprive that community of service. The underlying problem was literally not having enough locomotives and coaches to run the full schedule. And so they had to cancel somewhere, and they made a poor decision on where to cancel. So we've addressed that. But quite frankly, what we're really concerned about is making sure they have enough locomotives and coaches, because it's not really that much better if they just cancel somebody else's service.
Right. Well, let's move to roads for a minute, if we can, because we've got about 4 minutes left here. I want to ask you about the all-electronic tolling on the turnpike, because the toll booths are gone. And in fact, if I have this right, they all were removed a week early. You're allowed to celebrate, I think, a little bit.
Well, then I will, because I will tell you that the men and women at MassDOT, at our contractors, and at the state police did a spectacular job. This was months, years of planning for a very brief period of time in which we needed to get the new system on and the toll booths down, so that before the winter, before people's heavy Thanksgiving travel, we would have the turnpike in a good enough condition that they really would be able to travel. I also happen to drive the pike pretty frequently when I'm not on the commuter rail. And we gave ourselves until November 21st to finish the initial stage of removal, and it actually was done November 10th.
Wow. But we have had several listeners talk to us about what they believe are disparities in the new fare structures, the toll structures. One example we have is a new toll for drivers getting on the pike at exit 16 in West Newton. They'll have to pay 70 cents more each way. That's one of the largest increases. I mean, do you think that there are inequities in the new toll structure?
You know, the gantries were located by a public process where there was public comments before I was secretary, and by the time I came along, we had to work with where they were. That gantry actually represents a toll that was taken down years ago.
Right.
And so it doesn't make my neighbors in Newton happy when I tell them this, but yes, they're paying a little more now. They also went a decade without paying anything, while those of us who got on at exit 17 did pay.
Okay. Well, so I also, just in general, I love asking this question, even though I kind of know the answer. I mean, one of the criteria by which tolls were supposed to have been removed entirely from the Mass Pike was that the road needed to be in a state of good repair. That's obviously never going to happen. Is that ever going to happen? Or, I mean, are tolls going to be part of a driver's experience on the Mass Pike forever?
Like a lot of transportation assets and roads and bridges in Massachusetts, there hasn't been a great system in place to actually understand the condition they're in and have a plan in place to invest in them. So we've put a lot of effort, not just on the Mass Pike, but statewide, in managing our assets, understanding where the pavement condition is bad, where the bridges need to be fixed. We're investing those dollars. Will we ever get the whole system into a state of good repair? I don't know the answer. Will we get it into a much better state of repair? Absolutely. We are spending 80% of a $14 billion five-year transportation investment program on fixing the assets we have instead of on expanding capacity.
Hmm. Well, in the last minute or so that we have here, I understand that the American Association of State and Highway Transportation Officials had an annual meeting in Boston just this week. What's the nature of the conversation going on amongst your peers? I mean, is there excitement? Is there concern about the future? Because as you said at the beginning of our conversation, I do think that one area in which there is strong bipartisan support is that the transportation infrastructure of this country is definitely not up to speed, sorry, pun not intended, as much as it should be to support the economy.
So there was a lot of talk about the excitement about that infrastructure was kind of on the front burner and people are talking about it, because, of course, that's what everybody at these meetings lives for. They represent the heads of the state transportation departments. So we talked a lot about having a new six-year transportation bill passed for the first time in, you know, years. We talked a lot about the possibility that there would be more. And we talked a lot about some of the issues we've been talking about, which is kind of buckling down and fixing the assets we have and getting them in better shape so that we can give people a more reliable way of getting where they need to go.
Well, Stephanie Pollack is the Transportation Secretary for the Commonwealth of Massachusetts. It's always great to have you. Thank you so very much.
It's always great to be here. Thanks for having me.
We'll be back in just a minute. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Delegates from nearly 200 countries are in Morocco this week to work out how to implement the Paris Climate Agreement. That's the historic accord under which countries, including the United States, pledge to limit global temperature rises to 2 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial levels and to help poorer nations transition away from fossil fuels. However, with the election of Donald Trump last week, some environmentalists are concerned that the U.S. may backtrack. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry sought to reassure the conference today.
I can tell you with confidence that the United States is right now, today, on our way to meeting all of the international targets that we've set. And because of the market decisions that are being made, I do not believe that that can or will be reversed.
Robert Stavins is a professor of business and government at the Harvard Kennedy School of Government. He's also director of the Harvard Project on Climate Agreements. He's in Marrakesh running panels for the delegates about the implementation of the Paris Accords. And we spoke with him a little earlier today. We began by asking Stavins what effect the U.S. presidential election has had on the talks in Marrakesh.
Certainly the recent election in the U.S. represents the most dramatic change that we've had in the United States in political leadership, at least in my lifetime. And that's as true in the area of international relations, including climate change, as it is in any other. So naturally, the delegations here from around the world who are knowledgeable about what happened with the U.S. election are very concerned. They're aware of what Mr. Trump said during the campaign in terms of removing the United States from the international climate negotiations process, canceling the Paris Agreement, rolling back standards and programs in the United States on climate change. So they are rightfully concerned.
Did the Secretary of State's remarks give the delegates more confidence?
I think the Secretary of State did what he needed to do in terms of what he said. I think he's correct that market forces, that is the low price of natural gas relative to coal, will mean that there will be continuing trends of CO2 emissions coming down, particularly in the electricity sector, and that for other reasons there are movements now in the economy, lower price of renewables, so the U.S. will continue to make some progress. But it's surely also true that the commitment that was previously made by the Obama administration under the Paris Agreement, the 26% to 28% by 2030 below the 2005 level, was already going to be difficult to achieve. And now without the Clean Power Plan, which President-elect Trump has pledged to rescind, it's going to be even more difficult.
Now, Donald Trump did say during the campaign that he would cancel the Paris Climate Agreement. But I understand that President Obama ratified the agreement in September. It entered into full force on November 4th. So could a new administration actually cancel America's participation in the climate agreement?
Well, there are three things that the new president could, in theory, do. One would be to officially withdraw the United States from the Paris Agreement. That requires 4 years. You have to announce it 3 years in advance, and then it's a one-year process. So that would take us right through the Trump administration to its conclusion, or at least the conclusion of its first term. So that's not the likely course that they would take. There is another possibility that would be much more drastic and really quite terrible, and that would be that it requires only 1 year notification for the United States to withdraw from the overall framework convention. That's the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change, signed in 1992 by President George H.W. Bush and ratified by the United States Senate. to pull out of the convention would disrupt international relations in dimensions that go beyond climate change. So I can't say that I think the Trump administration won't do that, because I really don't know what they'll do, but that would be extremely unfortunate. The third possibility is simply taking actions, or rather not taking actions, domestically in terms of domestic policies, so that the nationally determined contribution submitted by the Obama administration is not achieved, that 26% to 28% reduction. That we'd still be in the Paris Agreement, but we just wouldn't be really participating, trying to do anything.
Did the election of Donald Trump and the uncertainty there now seems to be around America's commitment, long-term commitment, to any climate change accord, is that perhaps emboldening other countries who maybe did not want to sign on or were less enthusiastic about the Paris Agreement?
The Paris Agreement really was adopted, was written because of the outfront affirmative actions of China and the United States. So what's happened since the Trump election is that China has said, senior officials from China have said, look, we're staying with it. We're going to continue with what our pledge was. And we're quite interested in assuming global leadership on this issue because, in fact, we think that leadership on this issue, which we're happy to take, will spill over to other issues. So, ironically, this kind of action by the Trump administration could actually empower China rather than denigrate China, which is what it seems Mr. Trump wants to do, at least according to his campaign promises. That said, you're right to point out that it's conceivable, it's hypothetical, but it's conceivable that other countries, India would be a good example, might, as a result of this, the opposition forces within those countries who really didn't want to go forward with the Paris Agreement or with commitments or contributions might now be empowered and have a louder voice politically within their countries. That's my concern. That's my greatest concern, is that as a result of this, we might see some countries rolling back. However, I should say that here in Marrakesh, there has been absolutely, absolutely no evidence of that. I've spoken with people from a number of important negotiating teams, and I have not heard any hint of that happening.
Well, I see that also today, more than 360 businesses signed a statement pledging to do their part regarding the Paris Accords, and they also called on President-elect Trump and President Obama to continue to support the Paris Climate Agreement. The companies included some big ones: General Mills, eBay, Nike, Intel, Hilton. I mean, is there a sort of a burgeoning of support and pressure coming from the private sector to continue keeping the Paris Climate Agreement on track?
What private industry hates most is uncertainty. And so what the election of Donald Trump surely brings, unquestionably, is a tremendous amount of uncertainty, because no one knows what his positions really are or what his actions will be, together with or without the Congress. So in that sense, the status quo was the Paris Agreement. They were already operating in terms of that, and so therefore there's interest continuing with that.
Well, finally, Robert Stavins, I'm curious, because just this week, the World Meteorological Organization said that 2016 is on track to be the hottest year on record. Do you think that it's essentially too late for us to avoid the worst and most serious effects of climate change, that we're already well down that path?
Well, there isn't a single bright line at which it's too soon, just in time, or too late. The longer we delay, the greater the costs will be to achieve any target by any given date, because it means taking more drastic actions. It is true that 2016 is the hottest year on record. So was 2015. So was 2014. And so that is completely valid. It is getting more difficult to address the problem. But it is helpful to keep in mind this is a long-term problem, because these greenhouse gases accumulate in the atmosphere. If there's a choice between not taking action and taking action 2 years from now or 4 years from now, I'd certainly side with taking action 2 or 4 years from now. But taking action sooner is unquestionably better.
Robert Stavins is professor of business and government at the Harvard Kennedy School of Government. He's also director of the Harvard Project on Climate Agreements. He spoke with us earlier today from Marrakesh, where he's attending COP22, the meeting of nearly 200 nations, to work out details of the Paris Climate Agreement. We'll be back in about 90 seconds. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back. It's Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. You might remember last month, we spoke with Gloucester resident Diana Ploss. She'd been a lifelong Democrat who'd lived for years in Cambridge. But back in 2013, things started changing for Diana, and she registered as a Republican. She later quit her job and volunteered full-time for Donald Trump's presidential campaign. And in that October conversation, Diana talked to us about how she believed the nation was on the wrong track and how she felt America needed to come together as a team. Well, we invited Diana Ploss back into the studio today because we wanted to hear how she was feeling now that Donald Trump is president-elect. The second half of our conversation took a really surprising and personal turn. But Diana began by telling us how she feels or felt after Trump had actually won the presidency.
I think it was a couple days after the election because I was so tired working on it. I did kind of like, yes, okay? But my yes was more like, for America, like a sigh of relief. I don't feel smug. I don't feel like, ugh, we beat the other side. Uh-huh. That's never how I thought. Now, I feel like America was on a cliff. I feel like we're pulled back a little bit. We can regroup. So that's what I'm saying.
Yeah.
This is not a time to gloat. This is a time to, we're a team. Remember we talked about teams? We are a team.
Well, so let me ask you, Diana, because I'm really glad that you brought up this point. Because, yeah, last time we talked a lot about how you feel like America needs to be a team and come together. But you know that there are a lot of people right now who are feeling like they are not part of the team because they're frightened and they're worried and they're scared about what a Trump administration means to them personally in their lives. I'm thinking about people of color, the LGBT community, immigrants. What would you say to them?
Well, the thing is, for some reason, it seemed like polls weren't feeling the pulse of what was really happening with people who supported Trump. And I think it came as a shock to people who were reading. If you just read one part of media and you're listening to leaders, even Obama said Trump won't be president. This one said Trump won't be president. So, of course, it comes as a shock to people, right?
Well, I think people are feeling a sense of shock and concern because of what
he
the president-elect even
what they
himself,
think he,
well, what he said during the election. But then there's also this. Just recently, the president-elect named Steve Bannon,
yes,
of Breitbart News, as his role is going to be as chief strategist for the White House. Now, Breitbart has been, you know, a major megaphone for white nationalists. That is one of the reasons that people point to, like, that's why they're concerned.
So what I would encourage people to do is to read about Mr. Bannon. I always take exception to whether somebody says, like, white nationalist. Like, what does that mean exactly? I don't know what that means, white nationalist. What is that? I don't understand what that means.
Well, I think it means there's a group of people out there who believe that America should be a white nation. They want the white race to be, you know, the privileged race in this country. They also call them European ethno-nationalists. I mean, it is about race.
Is that what Steve believes?
Well, he's done nothing to disavow the people who do say it explicitly.
I don't want the country to be all white. And I know many of the Trump supporters who aren't white don't want the country to be all white. Like Chinese Americans for Trump, huge group, an enormous group. Why did they come? You have to ask yourself, why did the Chinese Americans for Trump, a million strong or more across the United States, why did they come out for Trump?
Yeah.
The Haitian community.
So, Diana, those are all good questions, but let me just phrase it this way. And I also then want to get
but
to...
But I do want to answer your question.
Yeah, well, so go
okay,
ahead.
So Trump supporters are not a group of white nationalists. We're a very varied group of people.
Yeah.
We're not monsters. We believe in America, and we believe in America first. What is so wrong with that?
You know, I think this is why this is such a complicated moment
it's
for
very
us
complicated.
As an American, because coalitions are always that. They're coalitions of different groups of people who come together to support one candidate. And the reasons why they might support that candidate are different. I take your point. You and many people we've spoken to and many millions of supporters of Donald Trump are not racist. But I think the thing that people struggle with is There was a writer who put it this way. One particular supporter of Mr. Trump may not be a white nationalist, but by saying that the things that Donald Trump said as a candidate and the choices he might make as president, which do hew closer to white nationalist thinking, by saying that that stuff doesn't bother them, that it makes it hard to say that they're not
supporting
inadvertently supporting.
Right, but how can you, how do you know who's going to follow you? You just can't, because what's the difference? Hillary Clinton had supported Black Lives Matter, and a lot of them have done not such good things.
While what you're saying, I think some people listening probably would object to it, I want to ask you about how President-elect Trump can lead. You know, because, for example, the Southern Poverty Law Center has already documented 200...
I don't believe them.
I do.
I don't believe them.
You don't believe that there
because
have been,
no,
there's been a, the FBI
no, I don't.
Has even said there's been a spike in hate crimes against Muslim
Americans. The Southern
Poverty
Law Center has a reputation of preying on people who are very poor.
Diana, I love you and respect you, but I've got to disagree with you on that point. Do you disagree with the FBI saying that there's been a spike in hate crimes against Muslim Americans?
I'd have to look at the statistics. I haven't seen them. I mean, they might be new statistics for the last week. I don't buy it.
Well, I think the FBI has been saying that there's been a spike in hate crimes against Muslim Americans. But what I want to ask you, to come back to your analogy of America as a team, if we take, you know, President-elect Trump is now like, he's like the coach of the team.
He's leading the team
yeah. now. If the team feels so divided, what should the coach be saying? What should the leader of the team be saying to bring that team together?
He has come out and said that he wants people to stop that, and he was interviewed on 60 Minutes. Well, he's not the president yet. I feel like Obama has to be the leader. He's the leader right now. He is the leader. People look up to him. He's still the president. Obama needs to get out there, and he has to quell this stuff. Because who are they going to listen to? They're going to listen to Trump right now? Uh-uh.
Well, they're not. But the folks who voted for him would listen to the president-elect.
Yes, but I would argue with you, but not in an argumentative way.
You can. This is an open table.
Right, but that's not the problem. Honestly, I would put it right back on you and say Obama needs to be the person to get out there as the president and reassure people.
So
it'll be okay.
he did say something to that effect in this press conference that he gave earlier this week. And I think he was out there in the days after the election, too. He gave a Rose Garden press conference when he said, hey, look, everybody, just want to remind you, the sun still rises.
Yes,
no matter
every
what.
Night, though, I think he needs to come out.
Every night. Okay.
I think believe me, I am not trying to minimize people. I'm not. But you have to take a step back. It is going to be okay. Yeah. It really is going to be okay. It is.
So one more question about Washington. So you mentioned about draining the swamp, as Donald Trump said he'd like to do when he was a candidate for the White House. There seems to be some debate as to whether or not that's actually happening, right? Because just today in the Boston Globe, there was a big article about how lobbyists, in fact, may be more excited than ever about their opportunities in Washington now, because there will be a Republican in the White House and in the Senate and the House of Representatives. This could be the gravy train for lobbyists. Does that concern you?
It doesn't. You know what concerns me more is that people write stories like that.
The Globe was quoting actual lobbyists who were saying this.
Right. But what I'm saying is, just because that's what they're saying and that's what they're hoping doesn't make it a fact. There are so many intertwinings, connections of people. That's the swamp. There's so many people tied into one another. And okay, well, if I do this, it benefits this one. If I do that, right? And that's what he's talking about. Those lobbyists, I think they're in for a rude awakening.
Diana, do you ever worry that you might end up feeling disappointed in Donald Trump because the problems run so deep that even he can't change them?
I've been disappointed in my parents. I think it's the same thing, right? I mean, nobody's perfect. Like I said, my opinion, Diana's opinion, is that we were on a cliff and we were hanging over. I feel like we've been pulled back. That's the biggest thing that Mr. Trump brought and that I hope that people will pay attention to. Even if they hate him, he said things that people didn't want to hear, right? They didn't want to hear it. And you know what? Some of those things turned out, well, yeah, he was right. Like,
I mean, I don't think...
I mean, I'm just asking. Yeah. Like, what is so wrong with America First? And I know you have your list of questions, but I remember the last time when I left you, I said something about my health insurance, and I'll take 30 seconds. I mean, I'm almost want to cry. I am
because
getting...
Because of the cost of your insurance?
You know how much my insurance is this year? I've already paid? $18,000. I canceled my insurance. I had to because I can't afford it. I'm also supporting my father. Why? Because he only gets $1,800 a month for Social Security. His rent alone is $900, and his health care expenses are about $600. His co-pays went up. So one prescription a month that he gets went from $8 a month to $44, right? 2 years ago, my father took an overdose because he couldn't pay to live. He doesn't have enough money to live.
Your father had tried to take his own life.
Yeah. So 2 years ago, he's not a big drinker anymore. He used, you know, he doesn't drink, bought like a bottle of scotch, was on Dilaudid for a pain thing, which he shouldn't have been on, but that's a different story. Took 24 Dilaudid, washed it down with like five drinks of scotch, and went to bed. And luckily, because my father's so good with his routine, he put his oxygen on because he has COPD and he sleeps with it. And he wasn't thinking, you know, he's drunk, he's high, whatever. And then he woke up in the morning. And fortunately, I had called him, and I was, you know, I'm a nurse and I'm listening to him. And
did he tell you why he did it?
He did tell me, because he couldn't afford to live. And so that was one of my decisions to sell my house, because I knew financially I couldn't work, support him, do the house, do my business. And so when I see people, even on Facebook, saying, well, what about this person? What about that person? I'm thinking, well, what about me? It's a lot of money that I give my father every month from the sale of my house, which I'm almost out of. So this is personal, right? I mean, it is personal to have to do something like that. And I'm not looking for like a pat on the back. I'm not looking for martyrdom. I'll figure it out. But I want people to know that when do we start taking care of the people that are here? Like, I need to take care of my father. And so I'm trying to figure it out, right? So now I'm canceling my health insurance and that money is going to go to help me take care of my father. What else can I do? So I have to ask people who are listening, what about Diana's father who has a name? His name is Richard. Doesn't his life matter? That's why I'm supporting Trump, because I really feel like why doesn't Diana's life matter anymore? Why does somebody else's life matter more than mine or my father's? That was supposed to be my 30-second, but it was more like 2-minute little spiel, because I'm honestly trying hard not to cry because it's crippling me. I'm crippled. I really am. So there you go.
So I want you to know right now, Diana, that to me and to everyone who works on this show, I believe that everybody does matter. Absolutely.
And I appreciate that. I do. I appreciate that.
And I will stand by that to my dying breath. So that's why I want to say thank you again for coming back and talking with us, because I want to hear. Everyone wants to hear. We want to share everybody's stories. Because I feel like, you know, when you talk about the team, if the members of the team don't understand each other, it's not much
right,
of a team,
exactly,
right?
Exactly.
But I got to wrap up. Is that
that's
all right?
Okay. No, it's not okay. it was wonderful chatting with you.
It's always
great. I always listened to you on the radio for years and years and years. Oh. Isn't that funny?
Now you're making me seem like I'm old lady.
I know. It's so funny to put a face to the name. And well, I always pictured you, I don't know, like top floor penthouse.
No way. No, I'm here in my jeans and my polar fleece.
Top floor penthouse. That's no. How I pick.
Hey, I mean, it's public radio. We're down here with everyone else.
And
okay?
It's beautiful, though. This is a beautiful studio. Yeah. It's beautiful here.
Well, let me just say, Diana Ploss, it is always great to talk with you. I thank you from the bottom of my heart for coming in, talking with us, and sharing your story. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And thanks to Cassandra, too.
Diana Ploss lives in Gloucester, and for much of the past year, she volunteered full-time for the Trump campaign. You heard Diana mention the name Cassandra at the end there. She was talking about Cassandra Sunt, one of our fantastic Radio Boston producers. Our team happens to also include Kathleen McNerney, Jamie Bologna, Allison Bruzek, and Virginia Marshall. Tim Skog is our technical director. Our executive producer is Hitesh Hathi. And today we say a very fond farewell to one of the most delightful members of the Radio Boston family, producer Emma Jean Weinstein. For several years, Emma Jean managed our arts coverage, she created our digital content, and she was the invisible hand behind our website. She also kept us on time and very organized with her love of a precise show clock, checklists made of hand-drawn boxes, and an insatiable hunger to get every fact right, every guest fully researched, every story angle thoroughly explored. Emma Jean, we will miss you so very, very dearly, but we know that you'll help take your new team to great successes, just as you did with us. Thank you again, Emma Jean. That's it for today. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.